for the early Jung, the archetypes you know about, he talks about archetypes, have been considered as something which is actually close to the mental, close to consciousness, but just a little bit more unconscious. So still being still part of the mental domain somehow. And then when he came in contact with Pauli, he actually made this very important move to pull the archetypes as psychoid now, not psychic, but psychoid, out of the mental into something that is neither mental nor physical. So the archetypal structures in the psychophysically neutral are the driving forces of everything, which we can then observe as manifestations in the mental or in the physical. Or even manifestations that happen both ways at the same time, and then they end up being synchronistic events.
Hi, I'm Ricky DeRiz. Welcome to episode 39 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Harold Attensprecher, a theoretical physicist with more than 3 decades of experience in interdisciplinary research. He is known for his work on complex systems, the philosophy of science, mind-matter relations, consciousness, and quantum theory. Harold co-authored Dual Aspect Monism and A Deep Structure of Meaning with Dean Rickles, which forms the basis of our conversation. We look at the differences in philosophical frameworks, including dualism, materialism, idealism, and how dual aspect monism links to synchronicity, where events transcend the mind-matter boundary, connected through meaningful coincidence. I ask Harold how this model fits with non-dual approaches such as Advaita Vedanta, and how practices such as meditation could open the door to dimensions beyond mind and matter. Harold, welcome to the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm really happy to talk to you about this topic of dual aspect monism. I wonder if we could begin, if you could give an overview, a kind of headline of the theory, and we can take it from there.
Most people are familiar with the standard different, let's say, frameworks of talking about consciousness and its place in reality. And there are, I think, two or three standard pictures that people currently use. One of them is dualist, like Cartesian dualism. They have two fundamental substances, the mental and the physical, and then the question is how they get along with each other somehow, right? And then what is currently even more prominent than Cartesian dualism is physicalism, and that's the doctrine that essentially there's only one substance, the physical, the material, if you want, and everything that does not seem to be physical in the first place is tried to bring into the physical. That can be reductive, that can be non-reductive, but there are different ways to negotiate that. Then a third position that is not so fashionable these days is idealism. That's just the opposite of physicalism, that the mental is basic and the physical has to be explained in a way out of the mental. Fairly hopeless undertaking, I would say. And so these are the three main positions. Dual aspect monism is a fourth one, which actually historically came into business very early on, namely just 20, 30 years after Cartesian dualism, Descartes. And the pioneer of dual aspect monism is Benedict Spinoza, a Dutch citizen of Jewish origin. He was then excommunicated by the Jewish synagogue in Amsterdam because his way of thinking was not considered in line with anything like the Jewish religion would require from him. And in dual aspect monism, and that actually answers your question from the beginning, dual aspect monism, the mental and the physical are still separate, treated as separate, but not as separate substances of which reality consists, but aspects of one underlying substance. And this underlying substance is conceived neither physical nor mental, so it's something third. It gives you a tripartite picture of reality, with the mental, the physical as, derivative domains of reality, and the psychophysically neutral, as we call it, as the primary domain. So that's the general scheme.
From thanks for that overview as well. And from there, do you or could you explain a causality and the relationship between a causality or synchronicity is probably as most people are familiar with as a subjective experience and the quantum and how that relates to dual aspect monism?
Yeah, let me maybe a step go one step back first, because in our scientifically or scientistically framed worldviews of today, usually when you see a correlation between two different events, A and B, let's say, then the first the I mean immediate reaction of a scientist is to find a causal relation between A and B that explains the correlation, right? But the correlation is something that you see first, and then you try to make sense of it. And the reflex of the scientist is look for causal relations between A and B. Okay. If you don't find the causal relation, then there's a second reflex. And the second reflex is, if it's not causal, it must be chance. Right? And then at that point, if it's not causal and it could be chance, then this the scientist's wisdom is at its end in a way, because there's nothing else than in the repertoire of scientific explanations of correlations, which could be a good interpretation of them, right? Now we know your question is for the a causal, right? The first part of the question is for the a causal. In physics already we know correlations which are established beyond any reasonable doubt, which are not causal, which are a causal, and that those are the so-called entanglement correlations, right? In quantum entanglement, we know that if you have an entangled state and make a measurement, then you get outcomes of your measurement at one point and at the other point. The outcomes themselves are random, are chance, are chance events. Spin up or spin down is not predecided. It happens just in the measurement. But there are correlations between the outcomes that are totally rigid. Although, and this is now the important point, although it can be excluded that these correlations are a result of some signal that goes from A to B or from B to A, that can be rigorously excluded in the experiment itself. Well, this is what required some thinking, of course, but a group in Paris, Alain Aspect and others, they did these experiments, and they were just amazing. It's just really a breakthrough in physics. But now we are still talking about physics, right? So in physics already, we have correlations that are neither causal nor are they just chance. This already happens in physics. Now, when you talk about synchronicity, then you open up a bigger box, of course, because then you are not talking about something that happens within physics. You're talking about correlations that people claim to see or report or whatever between the physical and the mental. So synchronistic events in the Jungian sense, that's where you're heading, right? In the Jungian sense would be correlations between events that are physical on the one side, and then there's another event, a mental state, for instance, an emotion or a feeling or whatever that is mental. So synchronistic events are correlations between something that is experienced mentally, first person perspective, phenomenally, if you want, on the one side, and they have a kind of physical counterpart in the external material world. And now, since we have no way whatsoever to talk about causal laws between the mental and the physical, causality in the usual sense is already out of the business to explain these correlations. There is nothing like a physical law between physics and something that is not physics. And then, of course, the second reflex of the scientist that I mentioned before would be, yeah. You know, these synchronicities, they are reported and they sound nice, but actually, it's all chance. Now, what Jung thought differently about this. Jung thought that there is something that can interpret these correlations, but it's just not causation and it's not chance as well. He came up with the notion of meaning, right? And with the notion of meaning, the meaning that the person whose mental state is involved in the synchronistic thing, the mental state of that person is also in charge of attributing the meaning. So, what do we have here? We have a kind of correlation between two totally different aspects of reality, the mental and the physical. So, a causal interpretation is out of the question anyway. And Jung would say that the chance interpretation also doesn't make sense because synchronicities are only synchronicities if there is meaning involved on the side of the experiencing subject.
Yeah. Thanks so much for that. There's so much to unpack, isn't there? So I'll choose one a causal route from that. So really, in the kind of overview of that, the significance being the very much the materialistic paradigm, which is so saturated and rigid in the Western worldview, doesn't explain for these experiences. And yet, as evidenced by the quantum revolution of what, 125 years ago, there is at least some understanding of that being possible on a quantum level. And also the need to integrate the subjective experience into models of reality. So it's not just like what you're pointing to, this idea that an objective physics is going to have the ultimate model doesn't quite add up to the subjective experience. Would that be a kind of fair
Yeah, I think so.
summary?
I mean, of course, if you are a physicalist of the, if you're a hard-boiled physicalist, then you would say, of course, there is phenomenal. People talk about phenomenal experiences, and you know, this is all nice, but we don't have to take that seriously because at the end of the day, it's all brain activity. So that would be the physicalist's attempt to integrate, but it's not really integration, of course, to integrate the phenomena. It's more like eliminate the phenomenal from discussion. And so this is one point. But on the other side, I just want to add a little comment because physicalism, some people think that physicalism is something that needs to be, you know, it's old-fashioned and it holds no water anymore if you're looking for something more interesting. But I would say physicalism and the physical is a wonderful theory and a wonderful worldview. The only thing that you need to make sure is understand its boundaries. It's not without boundaries. And if you're moving within the boundaries, it's wonderful. It's great. We understand so many things, and we have engineering and everything, which would be totally impossible without the physics, right? So I just want and do not want to create the impression that we should do away with all the physics because it doesn't help us with the phenomenal. That would be a total overreaction, I think, which you find in some esoteric circles or whatever, you know. That's not that's not that's unfair to the physics.
I agree with that. It's one part of a greater whole, and I know like this holistic interpretation is something that you talked to as well, and how the quantum kind of points to that interconnected nature. I wonder as well within that coming for my background, like in terms of practices of like meditation and what you might call pure consciousness, what Buddhism and Hinduism, what they within that worldview, or what they'd argue experiential reality, that there's one to use the same terminology, one underlying substance of consciousness. And I know in the Western model there's panpsychism, which is similar but maybe more nuanced than that. And for me personally, one of my questions would be, if there is, say there's this is it tripartite, is that the right word? Of
Yeah, we call it that way. Yeah.
yeah. So like an underlying substance, mental, physical. So you have that almost like a duality, but there's a joining substance that is more fundamental. How would consciousness in that in the more esoteric or Eastern model fit? And you mentioned boundaries. Like how at what point does something become mental and physical? Like how rigid are those boundaries and their definitions?
So my first reaction to what you just said was, as we have various worldview kind of models in Occidental philosophy, we also have not only one of these models in Oriental philosophy. There are so many, probably there are even more than I can think about. But for instance, some of them are very idealist in format, a position that I mentioned in the beginning, right? The position that actually everything is mental and from there the rest unfolds. And some people would call this ideal mental in the East, they would call it pure consciousness, or they would sometimes they call it global consciousness or something like that. But still, it has a mental touch to it, right? In that sense, it would qualify as a kind of version of idealism. And there are others like Advaita Vedanta, for instance, that is a position which is very different. That comes very close in my thinking, but I'm not an expert, I have to confess immediately. In my thinking, it comes very close to dual aspect thinking, Advaita Vedanta, right? And of course, there are also materialist positions in the East, of course. It's, everything that's possible has been thought at some point, you know?
I think as well, like the I'm sure you're familiar with like Bernardo Kastrup's I think he calls it idealism, like this kind of modern take on
Yeah,
the
that's true.
mental universe.
Yeah.
My like understanding of that in terms of Vedanta is, and again, like I'm also not an expert on this, but almost the distinction between awareness and consciousness and their mind. And my interest around that, because I agree in terms of there's often a really simplistic approach to the phenomena that is experienced within consciousness, just to use that terminology. And at the same time, you can't deny like the Jungian model that there's an unconscious that then manifests. So there's a distinction between what you, on a really basic level, you might say like content, thought, in Buddhism, even like objects and senses are content, and then the field of awareness in which that emerges. But in this dual aspect model, it's like there's an unmanifest and manifest process, and a distinction between the two that is almost, you could say, fits with occurring within consciousness from that Vedantic approach, that if that makes sense.
Jung, of course, Jung comes from his education as a psychologist and psychiatrist. So it's very natural for Jung to talk about consciousness and the unconscious, and trying to delineate those from one another. The late Jung, when he came in contact, when he developed together with Wolfgang Pauli, essentially, his ideas that we now call dual aspect monist, the late Jung made this kind of move from delineating the consciousness from the unconscious into something more broadly speaking, because for the early Jung, the archetypes you know about, he talks about archetypes, have been considered as something which is actually close to the mental, close to consciousness, but just a little bit more unconscious. So still it being still part of the mental domain somehow. And then when he came in contact with Pauli, he actually made this very important move to pull the archetypes as psychoid now, not psychic, but psychoid, out of the mental into something that is neither mental nor physical. So the archetypal structures in the psychophysically neutral are the driving forces of everything, which we can then observe as manifestations in the mental or in the physical, or even manifestations that happen both ways at the same time, and then they end up being synchronistic events.
So it's almost like the on a deep level, the source of subjective thought,
Now
subjective emotion.
the question that I heard, out of what you were talking before, you have to correct me if I heard something wrong. But the question, of course, is, on one side we would say what is mental is mental and it's not psychophysically neutral. On the other side, Jung also talks, especially in his final work, Mysterium Conjunctionis, he talks about experiences that are possible, not only about the mental, but about the neither mental nor physical. Unio mentalis and all these notions come up, right? So, and that is a problem for the model, because if you take the model too rigidly, then all your experience is in the mental, period. Right. Now, what Jung talks about is there are also experiences which are, however, not discursive in the sense that you can talk about them easily or communicate them in rational ways, but they are experiences of some kind of, Jung calls it sometimes immanent experiences that really show you something like intuitions or revelations, something like that, which give you a kind of direct access to the psychophysically neutral, to archetypal activity, for instance, something like that. And so you get this access, but as soon as you want to talk about it, you have to go back to your mental and try to make the desperate attempt to rationally reconstruct what you have experienced. And what this ends up with is, and you see that in all of the mystics of the Middle Ages, whatever, it ends up in paradox, because the immanent experience itself is not part of our logical discursive thinking. Once you try to put it into this, then you end up with logical paradoxes like the coincidentia oppositorum and stuff like that, because of Cusa and others. Or, that is the price you have to pay. If you have these revelation experiences, and people, I don't doubt that people have those, but then if you want to transmit that to your, philosophy colleague or whatever, then you have to be ready to accept the criticism that what you're talking is nonsense, right? Because it's not logical anyway, right?
That's really, really well put. I like that. And it does for me kind of satisfy that like non-dual experiences of oneness, mystical experiences
I
that
think that's what's at stake, yes.
almost as well to linked to like the Vedanta model, experiences that are more likely outside of mental activity, so more in that spatial awareness that can be practiced in meditation, and as you say, we're trying to describe, but also trying to interpret those experiences inwardly in a mental way can then actually create like a barrier almost between
Something like that.
the interconnection. How are you doing for time? We've got about 5 minutes.
That's
There's
right.
so
Yeah.
much to
Yeah, I know. Now, let me just make one recommend a book which is very good on Advaita Vedanta, because it's a book by a Western religious studies scholar. Elliot Deutsch. I don't know whether you ran across that name.
I might actually, is it called Advaita Vedanta?
I think so.
Because I might have it,
And
which would be
Elliot
a
Deutsch
nice.
was he was a professor of religious studies at the University of Hawaii. And he was also the mentor of many people who came from that place, Roger Ames and now Brian Bruyer and others. So he was a kind of nucleus of thinkers who thought about some of these oriental systems, but in a way that makes it accessible to Westerners. And that's because when you read the original texts of the Bhagavad Gita or whatever, it just drives you crazy, you know. You can't really get a lot of, you really have to be trained in that culture and in that language, Sanskrit, and so on. Otherwise, you don't have a chance to understand what they are talking. And Elliot Deutsch's work and others really makes an attempt to make that accessible for people who are more trained in Western thinking. And that's a very helpful, I think, work that they did.
Yeah, and it is that like you say, that almost a translation for like the hyper rational way of thinking that we have in the West, maybe versus the more of the intuitive,
For
experiential, and I
instance,
know Jung as
for
well
instance,
goes into that kind of irrational domain and the mythological. We've covered a lot in 27 minutes. I'm impressed.
yeah, it's not
It's
bad, is
not
it?
bad, yeah. So how much are we going to cover in half an hour? But
Do you have a copy of this book?
No, I would love to get a copy.
You
Yeah, I'm gonna.
should look into Routledge's website because they have now, I think it's for 2 weeks now, there is a paperback which you can get much cheaper than this original. The hardback was 130, British pounds, which was unreasonable, but now it's down to 30 or £35, and there you can find a lot of additional material. And if you have some more questions from that, then of course we can make another appointment.
I definitely have more questions.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think for my interest in, and also I think for people tuning in might be more open to different models or understanding their reality differently. And I think it can be really empowering to hear someone that can talk to the Western model and can talk to physics and the quantum realm, whilst kind of enabling that meaning can be something that transcends
Yes.
what we've been taught. And I think that as a message is so important. So I really, yeah, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. I know you're busy and you're taking time to have this conversation. I really value that. And I've got plenty of questions, so maybe we could do it again
Yeah,
at some point.
you just write to me when you think you might want to do another round,
Yeah.
and then we'll find some time.
That'd be great. Thanks so much for joining me today, Harold. Take care.
Okay, thanks.
Awesome.
Thanks, Ricky, for
Thank
having me.
you.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.